Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents James Axler's Outlanders. Narrated by Terrence Aselford. With performances by Nanette Savard, Thomas Penny, Richard Rowan, and Colleen Delaney. Outlanders number 23, Far Empire. Imperial Guard Corporal McCloy raised the visor of his helmet and lifted the binoculars to his eyes. He adjusted a knurled knob on the binoculars to compensate for the fast-fading light. The glaring yellow orb of the sun had already dropped halfway below the horizon, while the other half was draped by a thick stratum of fleecy clouds. Squinting through the eyepieces, McCloy slowly swept the ruby-coated lenses of the binoculars from left to right. The image enhancers presented a sharp image of the undulating plain. There was nothing to see but a vast expanse of coarse-grained, red-hued sand. He saw small depressions and prints made by snakes, thorny devils, dingoes, lizards, and goannas, but nothing else. He bit back a curse, all too aware of his superior officer standing beside him.
"I swear I saw something moving out there, sir."
McCloy lowered the binoculars and gave Lieutenant Yan a deferential smile. Yan didn't return it. He was nearly half a head shorter than McCloy, and his features, masked by the smoke-tinted visor of his black helmet, were Asiatic. Although the two men were very different in height and build, they both wore high black boots, ebony leggings, and tailored tunics of a satiny fabric. Emblazoned on the left sleeve was a red, thick-walled pyramid, enclosing three elongated but reversed triangles. Small discs topped each one, lending them a resemblance to round-hilted daggers. Both men had slender SIG AMT auto rifles slung over their shoulders.
"Don't get nervous. There's nothing out there but vermin. And they don't come close because of the construction."
McCloy didn't need reminding. From deep within the triangular slash of the cave opening behind him, he heard the clank of metal, the whining buzz of power tools, and the steady pounding of hammers. Faintly, he could also hear the obscenities uttered by a garrison of soldiers forced to act as a construction crew. Above Yan and McCloy, a massive dome of rust-red rock shouldered the sky. The formation was gargantuan, almost as mind-staggeringly immense as the Shan Pyramid in China, which had been the corporal's post for 3 months. For the past 2 weeks, McCloy's station had been at the base of the monolith of stone so huge that he could see only a small portion of its vast proportions. He still didn't know why he and 20 other men had been reassigned from Shan to the Australian outback, the ass end of nowhere, but he assumed it was the will of the woman known as the Imperial Mother. McCloy had glimpsed her only a time or two within the labyrinth of caves and tunnels as she inspected the work being done. She was the kind of woman men noticed. Tall, very shapely, and always poised. Her hair was very dark, her glance direct and appraising, like a commander viewing a new recruit for the first time. But McCloy wasn't part of her staff. She was always in the company of a pair of baronial guardsmen whose overdeveloped physiques were accentuated by the neat white uniform jackets they invariably wore. McCloy had heard of the baronial guardsmen, but never before seen one, much less two. He was fresh to the forces of the Imperator, a recent transplant from the barony of Tullia's magistrate division. His low scores at the academy had left him with two miserable alternatives, a clerk or permanent sentry duty, marching around in the heavy polycarbonate black armor. Since he detested paperwork marginally more than the armor, he chose the sentry duty. Fortunately, he had pulled guard duty only once in Tulliaville before he was ordered to trade in the hated black body armor for the much more comfortable black uniform of the Imperator. Feeling uncomfortable in the company of Lieutenant Yan, McCloy put the binoculars to his eyes again. He had seen a flicker of motion out there in the sand, behind the tangled thickets. The only movement he ever glimpsed during his previous tours of guard duty had been high in the sky, bat-winged creatures soaring and circling at the onset of dusk. One of his fellow troopers had identified them as flying foxes, but he hadn't sounded certain. Not that it mattered, since they never flapped close enough for McCloy to get a good look at them. He had on occasion received the uncomfortable but distinct impression the winged creatures were spying on them, even though there was very little to see of their camp. A handful of supply tents and the skeleton of a watchtower comprised the garrison's perimeter. A scattering of boulders and jagged outcroppings led up to the cave mouth. McCloy wasn't an imaginative man, but he was all too aware of the encampment's isolation, set into the horizon-reaching plains of desolation.
I told you there's nothing to see out there.
McCloy swiftly lowered the binoculars, worried that Jan misinterpreted his actions as a covert form of insubordination. Jan pointed to the watchtower and the outline of a man standing within the enclosed platform.
If there was, don't you think Lydecker would have reported it?
Yes, sir. I just thought... I mean, people lived here at one time.
Why do you say that, Corporal?
McCloy jerked his head back toward the cave.
There were paintings and things on the walls.
Those were made thousands of years ago.
Yes, sir.
The wind suddenly lifted, and dust rose thick about the perimeter. It swirled and billowed. McCloy hastily lowered the visor of his helmet, then stiffened in surprise when he heard the distant wailing note. For a few seconds, he assumed the sound was caused by the wind singing over the sand. But the dust began to settle, shifting like streamers of filthy lace, and the wailing sound continued. Jan and McCloy jerked, both men unable to stifle wordless outcries of shock. A long line of dark, slender figures stood inside the perimeter. All of them were naked to the waist, wearing only beaded loincloths and feathered headbands. White strips of paint decorated their broad-nosed, heavy-jawed faces. Some were bearded, others clean-shaved. Their eyes were lost in the shadows cast by their jutting brows. All of them carried oval shields made of cured animal hide, stretched tight over wooden frameworks, and long, shafted lances. McCloy stood motionless, held fast by the savage pageantry arrayed before him.
What the hell? Why didn't Lydecker?
His words clogged in his throat when he noticed that the silhouette of the guard in the watchtower was different. A spear transfixed his torso, pinning him to the wall of the platform like a butterfly to a board. Without waiting for an order, McCloy snatched the transcom unit from his belt and depressed the red button, the chicken switch, on its molded plastic surface. From deep within the cave, an alarm siren began to hoot. For a long moment, it was all confusion as men shouted curses, dropped tools to grab weapons, and pounded out side passages. Before the first man reached the mouth of the cave, the dark men swept across the plain like a wave. They didn't shout or scream or voice war cries. They simply rushed forward, shoulder to shoulder, moving in unison as if each one were a three-dimensional reflection of the other. Lances arced overhead, sticking quivering in the loose sand mere yards from where McCloy and Jan stood. The two hastily stepped back, unslinging and shouldering their AMTs. They squeezed the triggers and the staccato jackhammering of full auto fire drowned out the alarm. Against the swiftly moving targets, Jan and McCloy could only lay down their fire ahead of the onrushing line, hoping that they judged close enough so the savages would run into the hailstorm of lead. The range closed with alarming speed. The dark men leading the charge clutched at themselves and staggered, but the attackers behind them kept coming, pushing them headlong. They fell, dashed against the bulwarks of stone leading up to the cavern mouth. A volley of spears clattered against the cave. Jan fell back, a hand clamped over a wooden shaft protruding from his right thigh. Even running full tilt and in the fading light, the savage's aim was excellent. A group of black-uniformed Imperial soldiers raced out of the cave, firing as they came. The blended auto-fire gave rise to a deafening, prolonged drum roll. Their fire was disorganized and too rapid, but it had some effect. A few of the warriors toppled and fell, but the main body wasn't stopped. A trooper went down at McCloy's feet, writhing around the spear lodged in his guts. At that instant, McCloy would have traded all of his possessions, which were few and of poor quality, for even a partial suit of the despised mag armor. Another Imperial soldier went down, snatching at a spear embedded in his breastbone. McCloy caught a glimpse of the warrior who had hurled the lance, spinning, clutching at himself as the bullets clawed open his chest, sending fragments of clavicle and rib bones spinning off in all directions, propelled by crimson sprays. The rain of spears stopped. Then, as quickly as they struck, the savages vanished, seeming to be swallowed by the encroaching shadows cast by the giant monolith of rock.
Who the fuck are they?
McCloy's question wasn't answered. A trooper rushed up with a PRB-424 mortar launcher loaded with a 60mm Hi-X round.
Here they come again!
McCloy looked out past the boulders and saw the dark mass of warriors gathering once more at the same place they had begun their first charge. Jan was wild with anger and fear.
Mortar! Fire! Hit them hard!
The mortar launcher gouted thunder and smoke, but the projectile passed over the heads of the warriors, bursting behind them with no other effect than to shower them with sand. As another round was loaded, the SIG AMT rifles in the hands of the soldiers roared in a stuttering rhythm, tracer rounds cutting threads of phosphorescence through the twilight. The mortar spit another shell, and this time it landed in the center of the warriors. Dark bodies flew up, out, and apart amid a mushroom of yellow flame. The near-naked spear-wielding savages came on with fanatical courage, still fighting with a silence that was more unnerving than blood-curdling shrieks. Their bullet-slashed bodies dropped atop their dead or crippled brothers, but more appeared to clamber over the red shambles of maimed flesh and broken bone. The mortar launcher belched more rounds, just as fast as the soldiers could load them. Shell after shell detonated until the smoke and dust boiled high and the explosions rolled like a thunderstorm. McCloy, all but blinded, kept the trigger of his SIG AMT depressed until the bolt snapped open on the empty chamber. More soldiers fired their weapons dry.
Cease fire! Cease fire!
After a few seconds, the soldiers obeyed, but one trooper kept snapping his empty auto rifle until McCloy took it away from him. Jan, limping because of his spear-pierced leg, shambled around in apparent shock. But when a soldier offered to pull out the lance, Jan shoved him away with a curse. The men reloaded hastily, peering into billows of eye-stinging astringent vapor. As it thinned, all of the troopers looked for moving targets. When they saw none, they looked on the ground for casualties. They expected to see an open-air slaughterhouse, the perimeter littered with corpses and the wounded. They saw nothing, not even a spattering of blood, but the mortar rounds had destroyed the supply tents and knocked the watchtower off its support stilts. For a long, stretched-out tick of time, nobody spoke or so much as moved.
This can't be. We killed dozens of those bastards. This is fucking crazy.
As Jan coughed, pink foam flecked his lips. Trembling, keeping his jaws clamped tight so his teeth wouldn't chatter, McCloy slid up his dust-filmed visor and lifted the binoculars to his face. He squinted through the eyepieces, making adjustments so he could see through the shifting clouds of grit and gathering twilight. Focusing on a point beyond the perimeter, he looked for signs of the warriors' retreat, of marks in the sand where they had dragged away their dead and wounded. He saw nothing. Then a dark shape suddenly arose, as if disgorged from the shadows. For a shaved sliver of an instant, he thought he glimpsed one of the bat creatures flapping over the figure's head. McCloy's heart spasmed painfully in his chest, and his breath seemed to seize in his lungs. The man stood as motionless as a statue. Around his hips was a loincloth bearing a complex design of intertwining curves and arcs. He saw those clearly, far more clearly than anything else about the figure. The man's otherwise naked body was painted with alternating strips of bright yellow and red on his chest, midriff, and arms. McCloy couldn't see his face. For some reason, the electronics of the binoculars refused to bring it into focus.
Oh my God!
What is it now?
That man out there, sir.
There's nobody out there. Not anymore.
McCloy didn't bother to dispute or correct him. He continued to gaze at the shadowy figure. The man slowly raised his right arm. Gripped within his hand and attached to his wrist by a leather thong was a sharpened length of bone about 2 feet long. It was inscribed with symbols identical to those decorating the man's body. The bone pointed directly at McCloy, then slid to the right, where Jan stood beside him, then to the left and back to the right, as if the man were using it to count the number of soldiers assembled at the mouth of the cave. McCloy shivered violently and lowered the binoculars. He turned to Lieutenant Jan.
You don't see him?
Jan's face twisted in pain. McCloy started to speak again, then felt the warm trickle of liquid sliding over his lips and tasted the salty tang of blood. Murmuring wordlessly in surprise, McCloy dabbed at his nose and stared in confusion at the crimson wetness shining on his fingertips. Jan stared at it too, and McCloy saw blood flowing from the lieutenant's nostrils too.
Sir!
The lieutenant pitched into McCloy's arms as slack-limbed as a corpse.
We're all dead here.
A torrent of blood spilled from his mouth and splashed onto the ground, turning the rust-red sand into deep vermilion sludge. McCloy eased Lieutenant Jan down, chill fingers of terror knotting in his chest, squeezing his heart. He knew without knowing how he knew that Jan's wound hadn't killed him, just as he knew that he and every man in the garrison were dying. They just hadn't realized it yet. Scavenging trips eastward were, by and large, unprofitable, dangerous, and a complete waste of time. Although Mammoth Mayor McSween fancied herself a champion salvager, she didn't like to take risks. Most of the old pre-dark vills in her central Nevada territory had been looted of their valuables long, long before, and so she rarely considered it worth the effort to pick through them. What Mare usually looked for were items the manufacturing divisions of the baronies didn't make or didn't widely distribute. However, the southwestern outlands were pretty well cleaned out, so she and her crew of 10 men almost never came across anything worthwhile. The problem was that most of the places where tradable items might be found were more than likely slap square in the middle of hell zones, in the center of nuke craters surrounded by acres and acres of radioactive wasteland, or, like Frisco or Los Angeles, under several fathoms of the Pacific. Mammoth Mare McSween had neither the resources nor the inclination to seek out those possible treasure troves. Therefore, she suffered through one lean time after another. Looting the abandoned ruins of pre-dark villes was not only an outland tradition, it was also Mammoth Mare's family business. Her mother, her mother's father, and his father before him had made a career from ferreting out and plundering the secret stockpiles the before-time government had hidden in anticipation of a nationwide catastrophe. After the world burned in nuclear flames, debris settled into the lower atmosphere to very nearly create another ice age. The remnants of humankind had waited until the Earth got a little warmer to venture forth again. Most of the early survivors had been scavengers. They really had no choice. They banded together, found pre-dark wags, and recruited men and women strong enough to defend those armored vehicles. They raided villes of the dead where the radiation had finally weakened enough to allow limited access. They traded among the settlements, swapping equipment for supplies, supplies for gas, gas for ammo, and the ammo was used to blast the hell out of whatever muties or competitors stood in the way of their scavenging. Finding a well-stocked redoubt, one of the many underground military installations seemingly scattered all over the nuke-ravaged face of America, assured a trader of wealth and security, presupposing he or she didn't intersect with the trajectory of a bullet that had their name on it. Most of the redoubts had been found and raided decades ago, but occasionally one hitherto untouched would be located. Although Mare's mother, Big Ma McSween, had discovered some fine hauls in the past, crates of blasters, ammunition, even clothes, by the time she died after meeting up with a bullet, most of the easy pickings and higher quality items had become as rare as a smiling magistrate. In the southwestern outlands, what used to be New Mexico, Arizona, and Nevada, small, impoverished settlements were isolated by hundreds of square miles of barren wasteland. Although they were prey for marauders, Mammoth Mare didn't care to turn her mother's operation into that of a wolf pack. Her reluctance had little to do with morals or ethics. Most of the outlanders who lived in the settlements rarely agreed to give up their possessions without a fight, even if they were possessions they would have had difficulty giving away. Outlanders, anyone who chose to live outside baronial society, or had that fate chosen for them, were a different sort from those bred within the walls of the 9 villes. Born into a raw, wild world, they were accustomed to living on the edge of death. Grim necessity had taught them the skills to survive, even thrive, in the post-nuke environment. They may have been the great-great-great-grandchildren of civilized men and women, but they had no choice but to embrace lives of semi-barbarism. They were tough and vicious, and protected even their low-quality goods with their lives. As far as Mare was concerned, it wasn't worth risking life and limb to raise a settlement to the ground and then find out all they had were some old boots or maybe some home-forged black-powder firearms. So when she caught word that there was a brisk burgeoning trade in human beings out around the Timpayute Mountains, Mare began to seriously consider expanding the focus of her operation. Humans were legitimate commodities, and though there was no longer a thriving market for slave labor, due in the main to the magistrates, people were easier to find than usable engine parts. Mare's philosophy, handed down to her from Big Ma, was to always follow the path of least resistance. A number of her employees subscribed to the same "when the going gets tough, the tough get going" philosophy. The tougher the going got, the more they got themselves going, leaving her operation for greener pastures. Not that there were many pastures, green or otherwise, around the Big Smoke Valley she used as winter quarters. Mammoth Mare McSween's crew didn't have a permanent headquarters. They had to be able to travel with the trade, as nomadic as any group that made its living from mobility. New markets often opened up when other scavenger groups made new strikes, digging through rubble down into the pre-dark villes. Supplies had to be gotten to the other scavengers that joined them, as well as transport arranged for all the things they found. A permanent location would have been detrimental to profit. Despite having inherited 2 heavy-duty wags from Big Ma, not to mention a network of bolt holes, food caches, and supply depots, Mammoth Mayor found it increasingly difficult to keep employees, particularly those with an IQ greater than his or her shoe size. She was never sure why they kept running off. It was true, being a scavenger had become almost intolerably risky since her mother had been picked off by a Romer sniper 4 years before. In the interim, Romer gangs had become bolder. As a general rule, Romers were dangerous only to isolated outland settlements. Outlaw nomads, Romers used resistance to vil authority as a justification for their raids, murders, and rapes. Inasmuch as they stayed as far away as possible from the vils, she often wondered whom they thought they were fooling by paying lip service to a political cause. But lately, Romers had been attacking armed convoys closer and closer to the vils, as if they no longer feared apprehension by the magistrates. Rumors had filtered into the outland territories about an internecine war raging among the nine barons, so she assumed the mags were too busy dealing with that to track down Romers. So far, she had seen no evidence of a baronial power struggle, but then she tended to stay far away from the nearest barony, that of Snakefish. Muties weren't much of a threat any longer either. The worst of the bunch, the Stickies, had long ago been all but exterminated. They were one of the most common of the muti strains, spawned by the nuke cost of 2 centuries ago, and no one really knew where they came from or even theorized on what monstrous combination of genetic malfunctions had created them in the first place. Supposedly, none had even been seen until the first couple of years of the previous century. Then, like floodgates opening, sightings were reported from all over. Mare had never seen one, but she knew that about 100 years before, the Stickies had been terrors of the nuke-scarred country, because of their psychotic love of mutilating norms and torching settlements. Legend had it that nearly a century ago, a charismatic leader had united the Muti marauders to wage a holy war against the norms. As far as Mare recollected from the campfire tale she had heard, the war had not quite come off, but the memory of the threat was burned deep into the collective minds of the baronial hierarchies. It had burned so brightly that a major early aspect of the program of unification had been a campaign of genocide against Muti settlements in Vil territories. Therefore, she doubted the likelihood of members of her crew having fallen prey to Stickies. Granted, Mammoth Mare knew very little about the situation outside her territory, and she couldn't spare the resources or manpower to mount a dubious adventure east to find out. The possibility that her men were deserting her organization to join a Farer group was also so remote that she didn't even seriously consider it. Farers were nomads, a loosely knit conglomeration of wanderers, scavengers, and self-styled salvage experts and traders. Their ranging territory was the Midwest, so they couldn't have offered any personal inducements to her crew. Lately, she had begun to suspect the desertions were due more to her gender than poor pickings. Although she had been christened Mary Lou, somewhere in her teens, the Mammoth Mare sobriquet had been applied to her, probably after she topped 6 feet tall and began weighing in at 200+ pounds. Now she was 3 inches over 6 feet, and she had no real idea of her weight, but she guessed it was in the vicinity of 250. She took a secret pride in the fact that none of it was flab. Mare usually kept her dark blonde hair cut exceptionally short, and her normal mode of attire was a one-piece zippered coverall. To detract further from her femininity, she had adopted Big Ma's habit of chewing tobacco. But still, the men continued to quit on her, a few of them offering feeble excuses, but most of them simply wandering away when she was asleep or otherwise occupied. But she was never so preoccupied as to be deaf. She had heard whispered references to her as Mammoth Mare McSwine. A scrawny, sun-browned rodent of a man who went by the name of Squint had been the first to coin the name, and she overlooked the disrespect the first time. She liked the man personally. He was her most seasoned scavenger and served with Big Ma for a number of years, so his mockery had been like a blowtorch applied to her heart. The second time she warned him privately about it and went on at profane length about how she didn't find the nickname amusing. Squint pretended not to understand her anger and met her warning with a torrent of words. He was a yakker, not a conversationalist. Opinion poured out of him like water from a spigot, and Mare doubted he even heard her words over his own defensive yapping. The third time she heard him utter the name, Mare didn't even bother with a confrontation. She ordered him spread-eagled to the rear of a wag and peeled the flesh off his back with a horsewhip, her late mother's emblem of office and authority. Squint didn't die, but he was permanently disfigured, and as soon as he had healed sufficiently, he slunk off one night with a weak supply of MREs and water. As much as she wanted to, Mammoth Mare didn't track him down. Squint had enjoyed a certain popularity among her crew, and publicly scourging him hadn't raised her esteem in the eyes of the men. From that point on, they rarely spoke to her, and then only when she directly addressed them. She pretended that that was the way she wanted it. Her mother had told her many times that the female chief of a scavenger crew couldn't afford to get lonely or vulnerable. "You get too close to one of them slagjackers," she had said, "and some night he slits your throat and takes what's yours." Big Ma had a very low opinion of men, although Mare figured it had to have been fairly high at one time, otherwise she herself would never have been born. She often wished for a mate so she could have a child, but most of the men in her crew had spent their lives scrounging around the edges of hell zones and hot spots. Her mother had warned that such men could shoot nothing but strange, twisted seed that produced offspring fit only to be drowned as soon as they drew their first breath. Therefore, the female of the species was vastly superior, and it did no good to wish for companionship. Mare never sought it out, but she couldn't help but admit to herself she missed Squint. At about the same time, the rumors of a trade in human beings reached her through a couple of her scouts. They were third-hand reports, and her first inclination was to dismiss them. As a child, she had heard similar stories of cannibals running wild in the deserts, eating everybody and anybody they saw. She assumed the people trade tale was nothing but an updated version of that old fable. But the bizarre rumors persisted, and as puzzling as the situation seemed, she seriously considered sending a scouting party to check it out. Before Mare made up her mind, Squint came sauntering into the camp one sunset about 5 weeks after he had disappeared. He made no apologies, nor did he offer a single word of explanation. Instead, he began yapping in his characteristic staccato, full-auto fashion about the profitable trade in human beings out in the old dry basin of Groom Lake. He claimed that for the past 2 weeks he had been living with a band of people in a collection of shanties near Old 376, just outside of Big Creek. He assured her they weren't any kind of mutie. They were genuine, bona fide human beings, about as healthy as could be expected, so they definitely weren't dregs. Dregs were the outlanders shunned even by other outlanders. One of the legacies of the New Cost was a fixation on genetic purity, and an important aspect of the unification program had been the extermination of all human deviates, particularly muties. Although dregs weren't muties, they had been classified as such 100 or so years before. Therefore, they hadn't been spared the genocidal purges that virtually exterminated all the mutie strains, except for a few isolated pockets in dark territories. The dregs were diseased, genetically ruined human beings who had lived too long near hell zones and rad hotspots. They were the lepers of the post-Skydark world. Squint's story sounded convincing, although he couldn't offer much in the way of intelligence regarding the identity of the people, who the buyers were, or what they wanted the merchandise for. Mare couldn't help but wonder briefly if the cannibals were at it again, but now buying their food of choice instead of hunting for it.
"Whoever the buyers are, they're offering contracts. So why don't we let bygones be bygones and get in on this before we're outbid by small-time ferret trash? All I want is a little extra skimmed off the top, is sort of a finder's fee."
Mammoth Mare preferred to kill him, but the man was so persuasive she decided to check out his story. If it wasn't true, she could always put a bullet in his brain later. Or, she reminded herself, maybe even if it was true. She agreed for Squint to lead them to the encampment, and he made no attempt to conceal his smirk of triumph. The next day at dawn, Mare and her crew set off in her biggest, most heavily armored transport wag, a converted dump truck. With large rusting patches, dents, and the missing front bumper, the wag looked like a wired-together rattletrap, but it was a true behemoth. Big Mom McSween had killed any number of men who had coveted it and proposed to take it from her by force. The trip wasn't a long one, but it was rough. The wag, with its huge, knobby tires, rolled over the rotten asphalt of the highway. Mare, Squint, and Levitz, the wheelman, sat in comparative comfort in the cab. The rest of the crew rode in the back, where they were jolted, jounced, and bounced. All of them were armed, although Mare had warned them the objective was to take the people alive. She tried to make herself comfortable, but it was almost impossible with the constant jouncing of the truck and the hard seats with their broken springs. The asphalt had a peculiar ripple pattern to it, and weeds sprouted from splits in the surface. The rippling effect was a characteristic result of earthquakes triggered by nuclear bomb shockwaves. The wag bounced and groaned onward, pushing through billows of alkali dust. After a couple of hours of being pummeled, Squint directed the driver to turn northward, and the roadbed abruptly and mercifully became smooth. After another half hour's travel, Squint told Levitz to cut across a median strip and leave the highway altogether. The truck crossed the shoulder of the road and plowed through a high hedgerow of mesquite and sagebrush. An old, almost completely overgrown gravel path cut through the tangle of underbrush. Mayer figured it was an ancient maintenance road. Levitz downshifted and proceeded slowly. As the vehicle rolled farther down the path, the brush became sparser. Squint leaned forward, peering through the dust-filmed windshield.
Stop!
The wheelman braked the big wag to a groaning stop. He sat with his hands gripping the steering wheel and glanced questioningly toward Mayer. She, in turn, glanced at Squint. The little man met her gaze with a twisting of his lips she interpreted as a smile.
They're a little ways ahead.
Mayer instructed Levitz to turn off the engine, and she climbed out of the cab, dragging her Mossberg 5100 rifle from beneath the seat. Squint stayed put, watching her with inscrutable eyes.
I told you, they ain't armed.
Mayer worked the bolt action to chamber a .243 caliber round.
I remember. What I don't remember is telling you to sit on your ass. You're leading the way.
Squint hesitated for a second, then shrugged and climbed out. Mayer's crew clambered down from the bed of the truck and stood around it uncertainly. She told them not to wander off, and then she and Squint pushed through a copse of shrubbery. They hadn't walked far before the settlement, if it could be called that, came into view. It looked like the rough sketch of a shantytown someone intended to build one day. Mayer and Squint cautiously approached the outer perimeter, not that one was clearly defined. A square wooden sign hung crookedly on a tall post. The words painted on it were nearly indecipherable due to long exposure to the harsh elements, but Mayer was able to read it. The sign read, "Road Runner Station Members of Kiwanis and Rotary Clubs. We don't rent coyotes. Beep beep." Mayer was perplexed by the legend, particularly the last few words, but she knew there were plenty of crazy people in the Outlands. Anybody who lived in the Outlands had seen enough terrible things to push sanity right out of their heads, so she figured the people of Roadrunner Station were as fused out as some of the other lunatics she had met. A half-dozen shelters made of splintering wooden siding and rotted canvas formed a squared U-shape around the spacious central area. At the apex of the U, three of the ramshackle structures converged, leading into one another. The suggestion of a stockade fence was barely identifiable, rising from the sandy soil. On the other side of the settlement, down a short embankment, a thin stream of water trickled, curving around the farthest outbuilding. In the center of the settlement, Mayer saw the residence. There were four men, three white, one black, two black women, one white girl barely out of her teens, and four little kids. They sat around a collection of wagons cobbled together out of bicycle wheels and wheelbarrows. They were singing. Mayer could catch only half the lyrics. Some nonsense about having faith in the Lord and his angelic host, but still the song affected her strangely. It made her think of how lonely and barren her life had been, and she nearly burst into tears. She quickly got control and sneered at herself. What impressed and stunned Mammoth Mayer most was the fact that there wasn't one blaster among them, not a single home-forged muzzleloader, not one pistol or a rifle. The people just sat and sang, as if they weren't straddling the thin line between life and death. She found herself envying their ease, their foolish sense of safety. Even though they seemed too stupid to live, she envied them.
Do they trust you?
Squint lifted his nubby shoulders in a shrug.
Yeah, I reckon.
Then go out there and say something to them. Get them off guard.
Squint nodded and stepped out into full view.
Hello again, folks. Guess what? You're all going on a trip.
When Mayer moved out into the open and showed them her rifle, the people's reaction wasn't what she expected. One of the children burst into tears. Two of them ran behind the women. The men started shaking, all of their faces twisted into expressions of horror, but not because of the gun. They looked as if they knew where Squint and Mayer intended to take them, and the reasons why. They didn't resist, even though the children sobbed uncontrollably when Mayer herded them out of the settlement at Blaster Point. As she and Squint marched them down the path to the truck, she contemplated briefly taking the crying child as her own to raise, but she didn't give the notion serious consideration. Once they reached the truck, her men forced all of the captives into the back. Mare and Squint climbed back into the cab with Levitz, who keyed the engine to life. When the wag shuddered and began to move slowly back toward the highway, the prisoners screamed and a couple of them tried to leap over the side, but they were clubbed down. Mare ordered Levitz to stop so the prisoners could be subdued. Rather than waste time, rope, and effort tying them up, Mammoth Mare sent Elroy among them, forcing ladlefuls of dark liquid down their throats. It was a simple sleep potion, and within minutes all of them were slumped unconscious across the truck bed. Mare saw no reason to bruise and batter them after going to such lengths to acquire them in the first place. Putting them to sleep until they reached their destination was much more efficient than keeping them bound. She hoped that by the time they awoke, the transaction would be over. One of the black women was the most difficult to subdue. She didn't submit meekly to having the potion poured down her gullet, and she managed to bite Elroy's fingers and kick him in the groin. Mare then sat on her, held her nose, and dumped a measure of the liquid into her open mouth. Within a few minutes, she was slumbering, and the wag got underway again. The Groom Lake Basin area was less than 180 miles away, and Mare figured if they maintained a steady rate, they could reach it before sunset. On a flat straightaway like 376, the dump truck quickly built up a good speed, averaging 45 miles per hour. The wag covered 20 miles in a little more than half an hour. The highway was in fairly good condition, despite such obstacles as small boulders scattered across it and clumps of brush sprouting from the cracks in the tarmac. The terrain on either side of the road was bleak and dark, as if it had been exposed to open flames. The few trees they saw were leached of all color, a monochromatic shade of gray. It was like looking at the world through a set of night vision goggles. Although the sun overhead was bright, the countryside was various shades of gray. Dead brush crunched under the tires, falling apart like sculptures made of ash. Powdery sand and ash floated up in the wake of the truck's passage, coating Mare's throat so thickly that she nearly succumbed to a coughing fit. Drinking deeply from a canteen, she washed out her mouth. She had seen rad-blasted landscapes like this before, hell zones where invisible poisons had leached all life away. As Mare absently clocked the miles on the odometer, a queasiness, then a cold nausea, crawled into the pit of her stomach. At first, she assumed it was due to motion sickness, but when a lump seemed to form in her throat and made breathing difficult, she realized with a distant astonishment the sensation of sickness was actually guilt. She tried to ignore it, to push it into a dark corner of her mind. She found herself glancing through the rear window of the cab at the bodies huddled on the floor of the bed. She told herself that the people were just commodities, simply statistics. Life in the Outlands was never easy, and it was bound to grind up some folks. Morality had nothing to do with it. It was a matter of survival. Mare had no choice but to be hard-hearted, since the baronies hired their own traders, who in turn controlled the supply routes and made a profit that was plowed back into getting more vehicles onto the supply routes. Now the various traders were organizing, forming a consortium, and independent operations like hers were in danger of becoming extinct, just like the Stickies. She couldn't afford to feel sentiment over statistics. But the trouble was that these people weren't just a group of statistics. They had faces, they had voices, they had names. They hadn't crossed her path. She had gone out of her way to cross theirs. As the miles rolled by and the sun climbed to its noonday apex, Mare's sense of foreboding grew until it was one baby step below a full-fledged anxiety attack. The sound of Squint's reedy voice made her jump.
Getting closer!
Levitz cast him a quizzical glance.
Why do you say that?
Squint pointed through the dirty windshield.
Look up! About 11 o'clock!
Mare and Levitz leaned forward, gazing in the direction of the small man's index finger. For a moment, Mare saw nothing but a deep blue sky with only the wispy suggestions of clouds. Then she glimpsed a tiny fleck of jet black against the vast tapestry of azure. She managed to bite back a curse, but she wasn't quite able to suppress a groan. Levitz saw it too.
Oh, shit.
Both he and Mare instantly identified the waspish configuration of a death bird. The black choppers were the primary form of air transportation to make a comeback after the nuke cost, and they were the sole property of the magistrate divisions. Levitz instinctively lessened the pressure of his foot on the wag's accelerator.
What the hell is a death bird doing out here? We must be 400 or 500 miles from Snakefish.
Mare turned her head to appraise Squint with a slit-eyed stare.
Mags have a base out here, don't they? They're the people buyers, ain't they?
Squint raised a pair of conciliatory hands, but didn't make eye contact with her.
All I know is that there's a base out in Groom Lake. I don't know who operates it, but they got Mags running security for it.
Mare bared her teeth and clutched the man around his wattled throat.
If mags are out here, then so are the fucking barons!
Maybe we can just turn around before we're spotted.
Mare continued to glare at Squint while she thought over the wheelman's suggestion. Squint's lips writhed, either in a grin or a grimace.
Too late for that. They know we're here.
Mare's heart skipped a beat and then began to thud frantically. She released the scrawny man and glanced out the windshield again. Although she knew the Deathbird was a pre-dark helicopter, the distant sight of it awakened in her a superstitious dread, rekindling old folktales told around campfires about sky monsters, giant bats that haunted the ruins of nuke-scorched cities. The notion of cannibals bartering for her wares now seemed almost quaint. The Deathbird rotated in the air, banked, then arrowed straight toward them. It circled, hovering for a long moment. Mare could barely hear the droning chop of the blades over the rattle and roar of the WAG's engine. She figured the crew of the bird was examining her cargo in the vehicle's bed. The black chopper made a low, slow pass, flying alongside the truck, pacing it. Even through the smoke-hued forepart, Mare saw a dark figure making an unmistakable gesture that they should continue down the road. Levitz licked his pale, dry lips.
What should I do?
Keep going. Ain't no chance in hell about running them.
I give the orders here, pissant.
Levitz turned his terrified wide eyes toward her.
Then give some, for God's sake!
Mare looked past him at the Deathbird pacing them like a hungry vulture. Painted a matte, non-reflective black, the chopper's sleek, streamlined contours were interrupted by only the two ventral stub wings. Each wing carried a pod of missiles. The perforated barrel of the forward-mounted chain gun in its swivel turret winked dully in the sunlight.
Squint's right. We can't outrun them. Let's keep going.
Levitz nodded grimly and said nothing more. He gripped the steering wheel so tightly his knuckles were white, looking almost as if the skin would split. The road inclined slightly to the top of a knoll. Ahead of them loomed the jagged battlements of the rugged Timpayut mountain range. Mineral deposits glittered with the reflected radiance of the sun. The jagged peaks, much eroded by the ages, resembled the fangs of an unbelievably huge, fossilized predator. The WAG followed the chopper along the road, down a narrow pass, twisting between ridges of barren rock. At the bottom of the pass, in a vast bowl of desolation, the sear basin of Groom Lake was spread out. It was basically flatland, with no sign of desert scrub to relieve the monotony of the dry, sunken lake bed. There was nothing resembling a lake, not even a few puddles. The basin was sunk well below the foothills of the mountain range. Far in the distance, on the other side of the lake bed, a scattered collection of structures rose from the ground. They reminded Mare of the broken-off stumps of teeth. There looked to be at least a mile's worth of ruins. The line of structures was completely dwarfed by a building so tremendous in size it was easily seen without the aid of the binoculars. She estimated it was more than 3/4 of a mile long and 1/4 mile wide, and at the very least, 100 feet tall. 2 dark bug shapes hovered above it, and she guessed they were 2 more Deathbirds. A few yards beyond the mouth of the pass, a pair of small concrete block cupolas bracketed the road. Protruding from rectangular ports were the long barrels of big, multi-bored automatic weapons. Mare figured they were miniguns capable of firing 5.56mm ammo at the rate of 6,000 rounds per minute. If her WAG was caught in a crossfire between the two blasters, it would be reduced to scrap metal in less than half a minute. She saw no movements from within the ports and wondered if the minigun emplacements were remote-controlled. Past the blockhouses, pyramid-shaped dragon's teeth obstacles made of reinforced concrete lined both sides of the path. Weighing 1,000 pounds each and 5 feet tall, they were designed to break the tracks or wheels of any assault vehicle trying to cross them. Levitz braked the WAG and put the gears into neutral.
Now what?
Mare looked past the obstacles toward the ruins and saw a vehicle cutting a swath across the tableland. She knew what it was and set her teeth on another groan. A sandcat churned its way over the lake bed, twin plumes of grit curving up from the clattering metal tracks. The controlled roar of the 750-horsepower engine was easily audible, even though the cat was nearly half a mile away. A pair of flat, retractable tracks supported the sandcat's low-slung, blunt-line chassis. An armored topside gun turret concealed a pair of USMG 73 heavy machine guns. The WAG's armor was composed of a ceramic armorglass bond, shielded against both intense and ambient radiation. Or at least, that's what Mare had been told by her father. He had also told her that only magistrates traveled in sandcats or piloted Deathbirds. The sandcat clanked to a halt between the pair of blockhouses, and its gull-wing doors popped open. Two men climbed out, both of them wearing the magistrate-issue black polycarbonate body armor. A small, disc-shaped badge of office was emblazoned on the left pectoral. It depicted a crimson, stylized, balanced scales of justice superimposed over a nine-spoked wheel, which symbolized the magistrate oath to keep the wheels of justice turning in the nine baronies. The helmets were also of black polycarbonate, conforming to the shape of the men's heads and exposing only a portion of mouth and chin. The red-tinted visor was slightly concave. The design of the magistrate armor was for more than functional, practical reasons. The two men were symbols of awe, of fear. They looked strong, fierce, implacable, and not altogether human. Mare's heart spasmed painfully within her ribcage, and she felt her bowels loosen. She had never seen a magistrate before, and more importantly, she had undertaken a great deal of effort never to be seen by them. Big Ma had warned her many times that to earn a swift death, known in Outland vernacular as a mag's mercy, all she had to do was come to their attention. The pair of black-armored men stared at the truck steadily, expressionlessly. Neither one of them made a move to unleather his sin-eater from his forearm holster.
I think you'd better go talk to the mayor.
Dabbing at the film of cold sweat beating on her upper lip, Mayor nodded, then carefully opened the door of the cab. She stepped out and walked slowly to the front of the truck, moving as deliberately as if she were treading on eggshells. She made certain to hold her hands well away from her body. The death bird hovered over the lake bed, a few yards behind the sandcat. The rotor wash sent dust devils spinning and whirling like miniature cyclones. The bore of the chain gun seemed to fix on her like a hollow cyclopean eye. The taller of the pair of magistrates stepped around one of the pyramid-shaped obstacles.
Tell your driver to kill the engine!
His loud, aggressive voice punched Mare's eardrums, and she flinched. She turned toward the cab and drew her finger across her throat. Levitz obligingly keyed off the truck's engine.
You brought us merchandise.
For an instant, Mare wondered how he knew. Then she realized the Deathbird's crew had radioed in a description of the wag's contents. She nodded, doing her best to keep her face a blank mask.
Answer me when I speak to you, you Outland slagjacker.
Yes, sir. We have merchandise. Found him this morning and brought him here straight away.
A cold, stitched-on grin creased the armored man's face.
Tell your crew to throw out their blasters and climb down.
Mayor turned toward the wag.
Throw down your guns, then come out!
Far in the distance, she saw a pair of tiny specks looking like newborn tadpoles swimming through a clear azure pool. She paid them no attention at first, but as she began to face the mags again, she absently noted how the specks appeared to grow larger between one eye blink and another. She thought again of the legendary sky monsters, but knew the black helicopter was far more dangerous than any creature out of folklore. Her crew complied with the order, and a flurry of weapons flew over the sides of the truck's bed and clattered noisily against the ground. The men followed their weapons, taking a position in a ragged line at the rear of the wag. The silent magistrate moved forward, extending his right arm toward them. Mayor caught only a blurred fragment of motion, then the man's sin-eater slapped solidly into his open hand. Mayor had heard about the sin-eaters, of course. The big bored hand blasters were part of the magistrate mystique, the official sidearms that were as much of a badge of office as the ones they wore on their chests. Stripped down to skeletal frames, the sin-eaters were barely 14 inches long. The extended magazines held 20 rounds of 9mm ammo. There was no trigger guard, no fripperies, not a wasted inch of design. The sin-eaters looked exactly like what they were supposed to be, the most wickedly efficient blasters ever made.
Hands behind your heads!
Their faces pale with fright, Mare's crew did as commanded. Her temples throbbed with tension. At any instant, she expected both magistrates to let loose with a full-auto salvo, kill them all where they stood, and appropriate her wag and cargo. Her only consolation was that Squint would die too, but it was a small comfort under the circumstances. At the far edge of audibility, she heard a faint, keening whine. She wondered briefly if, in her terror, she was unconsciously making the noise. Then she saw the two magistrates glancing around in wonder and tilting their heads back, mouths gaping open in astonishment. Mare started to look up too, but at that moment the real sky monster struck. Grant saw the other two Deathbirds making a high and wide circling pattern over the giant hangar, or rather, the heads-up display in his faceplate registered their radar signatures.
Two more players on the field.
Kane's voice responded crisply in his ear.
I'm figuring they're about 3 minutes away at top speed, once they see us anyway.
Although they were flying low, the two Mantis ships had their atmospheric cruising throttles open three-quarters of the way as they streaked across the sky at 500 miles per hour. Within seconds, the men aboard the hovering Deathbirds would realize that the strangely shaped dark objects in the sky were aircraft, but neither Kane nor Grant was worried about engaging the birds. One of the reasons they had flown the TAVs, trans-atmospheric vehicles, from Montana to Nevada was to test their air-to-air and air-to-ground combat capabilities. The craft were little more than wedges with curves, flattened javelin heads equipped with two different kinds of engines, a ramjet and solid-fuel pulse detonation rockets, that worked in tandem to enable the craft to fly in a vacuum and in an atmosphere. They called the ships Mantas for a simple reason. The resemblance to seagoing manta rays was more than superficial, particularly when the ribbed, incurving wings were at full extension. The vehicles had 15-yard-long fuselages, 20-yard wingspans with 5-yard tails, tipped by spade-shaped rudders. They appeared to be made of a burnished bronze alloy, but in reality, the composition of the outer armor most closely resembled armaglass, the plasticized metal created in zero-G conditions and overlaid by a pyroceramic hull finish. Intricate geometric designs covered almost the entire hull surface, deeply inscribed into the metal itself. Interlocking swirling glyphs, graceful cup and spiral symbols, even elaborate cuneiform markings decorated the ships from stem to stern. The cockpits were almost invisible, little more than elongated oval humps in the exact center of the sleek topside fuselages. The hulls were smooth, with barely perceptible seams where the metal plates joined. The craft had no external apparatus at all, no fins, no exhaust ports. In the pilot's seat of his Manta, Grant wore a bronze-colored helmet with an opaque full-face visor. The back of the helmet was attached to the headrest of the chair, and a pair of tubes stretched from the rear to an oxygen tank at the back of the seat. The chair and helmet were of one piece, a self-contained unit. The interior curve of the helmet's visor swarmed with CGI icons of sensor scopes, rangefinders, and various indicators. Seeming to float in the air between his eyes and the visor, a column of numbers appeared, glowing red against the pale bronze. When he focused on the distant object, the visor magnified it and provided a readout as to distance and dimension. Now he focused on the Deathbird hovering above the Sandcat at the leading edge of the dry lake bed. Even though he was intimately familiar with them, the Deathbird attack helicopters were frightening pieces of machinery. They were modified AH-64 Apache attack gunships, and most of the ones in the Magistrate Division fleets had been re-engineered and retrofitted dozens of times. 30 feet long, 15 feet high, the maximum speed of the insect-like choppers was 185 miles per hour. In the hands of an experienced pilot, they could maneuver like hummingbirds, up, down, sideways, backward, all very swiftly and fairly quietly. Grant glanced out the cockpit canopy and saw Kane's ship nosing ahead of his.
You ready?
Grant wasn't surprised, but he was annoyed. Kane was a born and bred point man. During his mag days, because of his uncanny ability to sniff danger in the offing, he was always chosen to act as the advance scout. Kane claimed that when he took point, he felt electrically alive, sharply attuned to every nuance of his surroundings and what he was doing.
How about dropping back?
Grant didn't bother to disguise the irritation in his tone.
Sorry, old habits and all that. Yeah, I know all about your old habits. They've nearly gotten me killed a few times. Let's do this together.
Hit the bird at the same time?
Why not? Let's do it.
Kane's Manta ship tipped up on the starboard wing and banked away, arrowing in on the Deathbird from the left. Grant's fingers squeezed the triggers on the control stick just as rockets flamed from the wings of Kane's craft. Grant fired off two mini sidewinders. The combined missile barrage hit the Deathbird amidships. To Grant's surprise, the chopper split in two a second before its fuel tank exploded. The craft sideslipped to starboard and plummeted straight down as if it had been dangling from a string that had been cut. The rotor blades fanned the air sluggishly, even as it plunged toward the ground. Grant pulled back on the stick to avoid colliding with the spray of flaming debris. His Manta ship and Kane's roared by on either side of the thick column of smoke, leaving such a whirlwind in their wakes that plumes of vapor followed them like accusatory fingers. As he reduced his ship's speed to 100 miles per hour, Grant's ears started buzzing. He recognized the sound as the radar lock-on warning, piped from the forward sensor array into his helmet.
Hear that? Very clearly.
He punched a series of numbers into the flight control computer, trying to achieve a fix on the radar emitters.
We should have known they'd beef up the perimeter defenses after the last time we were here.
A red square of light suddenly appeared on Grant's HUD, superimposed over a small grid-enclosed area of the terrain. Simultaneously, the warning chime sounded. Then another red glowing square appeared and the chime bonged again. From the lake bed, two cylindrical 10-foot-tall towers arose, sand and pebbles cascading down from their domed tops. The towers rotated, the laser targeters mounted on top of them popping on, following the Mantis flight path. Protruding from four oblong slits on each side of the towers were multiple blaster barrels. Grant stared at the image of the Vulcan Phalanx gun housings on his helmet display. The rotating, multi-barreled weapons fired uranium-tipped explosive shells at 6,600 rounds per minute. The Vulcan Phalanx system was a standard defense of the network of Vils stretching across the length and breadth of the country. The housings were automated, containing tracking and firing control radars. He and Kane had seen similarly camouflaged emplacements before. Flickering spear points of flame erupted from the slits of the housing. Kane's Manta lurched to port as a shell exploded in a flaring shower of metal and flame against the tip of its starboard wing. The fragments rattled noisily against the fuselage of Grant's ship.
Climb!
Applying full throttle, Grant pulled the tab into a steep climb, the Manta rising so swiftly and sharply that it appeared to be standing on its tail. The maneuver created a force equivalent to three times that of gravity, but the pilot seats instantly compensated for the increased pressure. At the apex of the ascent, with the airspeed decreased to 30 knots, Grant pushed the stick forward and nosed the Manta into a steep dive. The cockpit resonated with the high-pitched whine of the stressed ramjets and the slipstream of air sliding around the hull. He dropped the TAV rapidly to an altitude of barely 50 feet while increasing its airspeed to 120 miles per hour. Absently, he saw Kane expertly duplicating the maneuver. Both men leveled off their crafts, and the Mantas hurtled forward, skimming the rocky ground, leaving streams of grit swirling in their wake. The thudding hammer of the Vulcan Phalanx guns continued, and Grant knew the few seconds' respite from the radar could be counted on the fingers of one hand. The tracking controls would reestablish their lock at any second. His fingers hovered over the nose-mounted cannon trigger, and his HUD automatically adjusted the CGI crosshairs, superimposing them over the image of the gun turret. The warheads of the cannon shells contained incendiary properties, and the immediate result of an impact was a flash fire. If the projectiles struck a flammable target such as a fuel tank or ammunition, it would cause them to instantly explode. Grant achieved target acquisition and squeezed the trigger. A stream of armor-piercing steel and tungsten carbide shells punched a cross-stitch pattern in the dirt in front of the housing. The lines of impact scampered across the lake bed, flinging divots and tongues of flame in all directions. They intersected with the base of the tower, penetrated the metal, and the explosive warheads detonated. The Vulcan Phalanx gun tower was swallowed by a billowing red-orange fireball.
You want to take the other one, or should I give you the birds?
All things being equal, I'll give the birds my undivided attention.
Although he was sorely tempted, Kane didn't fly toward the gargantuan hangar or the scattering of ruins. He knew 99% of the Area 51 installation lay deep beneath Groom Lake, shielded by hundreds of feet of steel-reinforced bedrock. The base extended even into the foothills of the mountain range, so there was little point in staging an attack against the surface structures. They were exactly what they looked like, ruins dating back to the nuke cost. He jockeyed his tab toward the swiftly approaching Deathbirds, pulled the Manta into a climb, and performed a swift loop that sent the little space plane arrowing toward the choppers from behind. The bird on his right veered around in a fast curve, a Shrike missile flaring from its portside stub wing. It streaked beneath the Manta and impacted against the lake bed amid a spray of gravel, sand, and a yellow-orange fireball. Kane pulled back on the joystick controls again and went up over the Deathbirds, banked in the opposite direction, then dived again. Opening full throttle, he sent the Manta skating beneath the helicopters and turned sharply into a barrel roll. Through the canopy, Kane saw the horizon wheeling crazily. When it straightened out, he brought the closer of the choppers into target acquisition and squeezed the cannon's trigger. He glimpsed a ragged series of holes appearing in the black hull of the bird, then a shaved sliver of a second later, he was all but blinded by a hell-hued blossom of light as the Deathbird's fuel tank ruptured, ignited, and exploded. Flying pieces of machinery rang reverberating chimes on the Manta's hull. Fragments of the main rotor blade, pinwheeling at incredible velocities, smashed into the TAV's frontal armor and bounced away. Cursing, Kane pushed the control stick forward and put the craft into a sharp dive. Then he pulled up equally sharply. A missile smoked from the surviving Deathbird's launcher, arcing well below him. The Deathbird climbed in wind-screaming pursuit, little spear points of orange flame flickering from the chain gun. Kane winced at the series of ear-knocking clangs as 50-caliber rounds struck the Manta's hull. Kane didn't know if the TAV's armor would withstand a prolonged pounding of 50-caliber blockbusters, but he was certain a high-X missile scoring a direct hit would certainly disable the ship. Most of the Shrikes carried incend and high-X warheads, so a solid strike had the capacity of piercing armor plate to a depth of 12 inches. Kane pulled back on the stick, dropping both the Manta's speed and altitude. The Deathbird overshot him, roaring directly overhead. It fought to turn to face him, performing a straining, clumsy pirouette until the tinted plexiglass port faced the Manta. Missiles burst from both the bird's wings, streaking and flaming all around. For a moment, all Kane could see were yellow-red tongues of fire and spark-shot vapor trails. He banked sharply 90 degrees to starboard. A hail of steel-jacketed hornets stung and splattered against the wings of the Tab as the Deathbird unleashed its full arsenal of machine gun fire and missiles. Craters of varied size and shape burst open in the lake bed. Kane pulled back on the control stick, and the acceleration of the vertical thrust slammed down on him, pushing him hard against the back of his chair. The HUD's speed gauge icon scrolled with numbers. He disengaged the throttle until the Manta lost speed. Then he ruddered the craft around sharply, shoving the joystick forward. Kane dropped the ship in a sharp dive and came rushing up on the Deathbird from below and behind. The sensor scope targeted the chopper, and he launched two missiles. The missiles flamed from their pod sheaths on the Tav's wings. He felt the craft shudder slightly with the explosive release of the projectiles. The missiles inscribed fiery trails toward the Deathbird. Kane sent the Manta straight up, engines at full thrust and over on its back in a half roll. The Sidewinders impacted against the Deathbird and detonated in eruptions of fiery smoke. Shards of metal spun out in flashing, flaming sprays. The bird's control cables were sheared away, locking out the horizontal and vertical stabilizers. An oil line burst amid a squirting of black fluid, and the engine stopped. Kane caught a fragmented glimpse of an orange mushroom of fire ballooning outward from the Deathbird's fuselage. The black chopper slid sideways in the air at a swiftly decreasing angle and plowed into the ground. The whirling blade struck the hard-packed earth and shattered into gleaming shards. The entire body of the aircraft exploded a moment later, a sheet of flame interwoven with boiling coils of red and orange, leaping in all directions like the blossoming petals of a huge flower. A funnel of gray smoke billowed skyward, flickering sparks corkscrewed into the air like a swarm of fireflies just released from a jar. Kane saw another flower of flame blooming in the lake bed, and through the canopy he saw the second gun housing engulfed in a lapping cocoon of fire. Grant's Manta soared over it.
Took you long enough to attend to that damn thing.
I held back in case you needed help with the birds.
Thanks. You want my help with the cat?
Sure. Why the hell not?
The Sandcat had begun chugging at top speed away from the blockhouses, cutting a straight swath across the basin toward the distant collection of ruined buildings. The snout of the MG in the turret swiveled and spit flame toward them. Kane swerved as a few stray bullets sparked off the Manta's hull.
You know, I think we've made our point. We could just let them go.
There was a moment of silence as though Grant were pondering the merits of the suggestion.
Nah.
He dived in toward the fleeing vehicle, a missile bursting from his Tav's wing. The Sidewinder vectored in and exploded in a flaring fireball on the Sandcat's rear armor, spreading a blanket of flame up over the ob ports and the gun turret. The warhead punched a deep cavity into the back of the cat. The concussion shook the vehicle violently, and fragments of metal spun away from the chassis. The left side treads sheared away from the rollers, the entire track thrashing in a long, flapping strip, crashing against the hull. Sparks showered, and metal screamed as the treads slashed deep scars into the armor. The vehicle rocked to a shuddering, clanking halt. Smoke boiled from the gun ports and the seams, but the doors weren't flung open. Circling the disabled vehicle, Kane assumed the mags inside the Sandcat had either been incinerated or suffocated. Neither possibility made him feel happy. Grant suddenly spoke calmly, as if he were announcing his intent to take off his shoes.
I'm taking out the gun emplacements next. All by yourself? All by myself. For all we know, there may be mags in them. True enough.
Grant's Manta came screaming in around a fast, flat crescent. He expended two missiles apiece on the blockhouses, and all four struck dead on target. The cupolas vanished in eruptions of billowing orange-yellow flame. The quadruple detonations hurled chunks of concrete upward like a reversed hailstorm. A magistrate lunged away from the right-hand blockhouse, sprinting madly toward the burning Sandcat. Grant triggered the nose cannon, a jackhammering roar sounding like stuttering thunderclaps. The short burst of tungsten carbide shells spun the mag in a spray of blood, flinders of black polycarbonate armor flying away from his body. Fountains of dust exploded all around him as he hurtled backward, his chest seeming to burst open in tatters.
And that is pretty much that.